Hey, what's up? I should always start the show with a good throat clearing. I know you like that, especially those of you with headphones on. Anyway. Hey, it's the show. Unfortunately for you, it's my show, but the good news is I got some good guests on today. Michael Schwartz will be here, and Dar Jamail, both on Iraq. And also a ton of news. Obviously, the Iraq-Syria conflict. Police action. Whatever you call it. It is the top news of the day, but there's a lot more, too. First of all, did you see this? Did you hear about this? Vladimir Putin has renounced the Russian parliament's authorization for the use of force in Ukraine. He told them to take it back. Don't worry. All the people who have said for months now that Russia is about to invade eastern Ukraine any minute now won't have to be ashamed or embarrassed. Won't have to be accountable for being so wrong so often, because they're wrong in favor of what the government wants to hear, wants us to hear. And so it's fine. They might as well have been lying us into war with Iraq. No problem. No harm, no foul. I'm not sure who gets to make up those rules, but that's how it goes. What the hell happened to my mic? It's too low. How about now? Did I do that? Huh. Guess I could have. Anyway. From Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com, Putin renounces parliament's authorization for force against Ukraine. Ceasefire in doubt after Ukraine rebels shoot down military helicopter. Russian President Vladimir Putin has publicly renounced a parliamentary authorization for the use of force against Ukraine. Military force. Urging the Ukrainian government and rebels to take advantage of the ongoing ceasefire and engage in substantive talks. Putin offered tentative backing for the ceasefire itself, saying it was a good start, but urging them to extend it beyond the single week both sides have agreed to so far. Yesterday, that ceasefire looked very promising indeed, with both sides meeting for preliminary talks on a settlement on the ongoing eastern conflict. Overnight clashes in a helicopter down near Slovensk have the situation in serious doubt again. The Ukrainian government reported the Mi-8 helicopter was shot down, killing 9 people, including people who were installing equipment to monitor the ceasefire. Which rebel faction fired the missile was unclear, and the government reported those responsible fled to a nearby village. Major factions within the People's Republic of Donetsk appeared to be abiding by the ceasefire and looking for talks. Ain't that something? And seems like, I don't know whether, you know, direct contact or just through the language of PR, international relations and doing things, it seems to me like what the Russians are telling the guys in Kiev is that, listen, you know the Americans do not have your back on this. They're already off chasing kidnapped girls in Nigeria, going back to Iraq and screwing around anywhere and everywhere but here. And you're going to have to be a neighbor of ours for the long term. And how are you going to keep your stove burning? So how about you guys back down and we'll back down and everybody have some talks. Doesn't that sound like what's going on here? The government in Kiev, when the chocolate king Poroshenko came into power, the first thing he did was started bombing the east, called it a counterterrorism campaign and all of that, organized the right sector Nazis as the new National Guard with their leader Yarosh as the head of the, whatever they call them, the head of the secret police, basically. And, but anyway, calling a unilateral ceasefire, that's pretty good for Kiev. And then it seems like it's pretty related. Probably coordinated over the telephone, right? With the Russians. Said, okay, and they'll go ahead and do their part to settle this thing down, too. That's the first time I've heard of a president of any country refusing to take the opportunity to implement an authorization to use military force since Grover Cleveland refused to invade Hawaii. Have you ever heard of that? A Congress saying, go ahead and invade somewhere, and an executive saying, no. It was just a bluff. Well, there you go. So, might Russia invade Ukraine someday or something? I don't know. Why not? But this crisis was caused by the United States and our sock puppet satellite states like Germany intervening in Ukrainian affairs and bringing it to this. And it looks like, just like in Syria, looks like Vladimir Putin's coming to America's rescue again. Nobody wants this to be a real crisis, right? So how do we settle things down? All the Americans can seem to think to do is to send more money and more weapons, even. And they say non-lethal aid, but weapons too, to try to build up the Ukrainian military. The Russians are saying, let's make a deal. Isn't that what's going on here? I guess I don't know that for certain, but it sure seems like if Putin is willing to renounce the authorization to use military force right at the time that Kiev is saying, okay, let's cease fire and talk, then that's pretty good. I don't know how much influence, you know, the warmongers and the propagandists of the empire and their useful idiots like to pretend that all the dissent in the East is all because of Russia. Is all just, foreign government intervention rather than people in the East who are rightly afraid of seeing these Svoboda and right sector Nazis coming to power, where they were appointed to, half a dozen at least major positions in the coup d'etat overthrow of the democratically elected leader back in February. Why would anyone resist the authority of a foreign government and Nazi-backed putsch over their democratically elected leader? I can't imagine. It must be because the Russians are making them pretend that they don't like Dmitry Yurash and his happy tribe of Hitler-loving banderists. No one would ever just, not want to go along with that. Some must be manipulating them into pretending that they don't want to be under the thumb of a bunch of banderist Nazis, right? It's the only explanation. All right, anyway. Cool. Got Marcy for 2:30. Excellent. Lots of news to cover with her today. So, anyway, here you go. Russia did not invade Ukraine. Did not take the East, did not take Odessa, did not take the Transdniester, however the hell you say it. There are a few different names for it. All the predictions of the war party were wrong. And you see, the whole narrative that this is the new rise of the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire and that they're the ones who started this and all that, that was all just a lie. They were lying right to your face. It was the Americans who did this, who told the Ukrainians, you have to have a deal either with our side or with theirs, but you can't have a trade deal with both. You have to choose. And probably in order to provoke refusal on the part of the president at the time. And then they did a coup, and they used Nazis to do it. And they created this crisis, and... well, it looks like now it's beginning to settle down. It's not over yet. But they're now talking with the guys that were calling terrorists last week, so that's pretty good. Yeah, terrorists, those who resist foreign-backed Nazi coups. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Some of the things that liberals write, I just don't understand what the hell they're talking about. They're kind of crazy. All right, I'm Scott. Michael Schwartz coming up on the show. All liberals on the show today. Michael Schwartz, Dar Jamil, Marcy Wheeler. I was just reading this thing. Saying that there ought to be a bunch of regulations about how you store your gun at your house, which I completely oppose all regulations about anything at all. But I do think that, you know, you should store your gun in a way where your stupid 13-year-old son can't get his hands on it and do something stupid with it. Or your 4-year-old, either. That kind of thing. But pass a bunch of laws about that? What are you, crazy? What are you talking about? And then... But he ends the argument at the Daily Beast. The guy ends his argument with quoting Keanu Reeves from a movie complaining that they, the state, you know, that created us, let anyone be a parent without a license. And what sense does that make? You have to have a license to drive a car, but you don't have to have a license from the government to raise a child? And he says, he quotes this, and it's Keanu Reeves, right? The guy from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is the guy he's quoting. And I think he's quoting another one of his characters from some other movie. And he's saying this as though, yeah, which of course, I mean, God, obviously all of us agree that the government should be in charge of licensing who's allowed to be a parent or not. But now it's even worse. Now... we got these people who don't think that they should have to have a license for where in the house they keep their guns or what now? I don't know, man. Liberals. They're just so conservative, you know? Anyway, Schwartz and Jamail both on about Iraq. Marcy on about some legal issues. The Supreme Court has ruled today that, yeah, you need a warrant to search somebody's cell phone. And it was funny. I just tweeted two things in a row. The first one was Trevor Tim quoting part of the Supreme Court decision that says, kind of snarkily, get a warrant. And Trevor Tim told it, mic drop, like, blam. Kind of, you just lost a rap battle to Antonin Scalia. Get a warrant. And then the next one I saw at page now, because I thought, yeah, that's pretty good for the Supreme Court in this day and age to protect the civilians from the depredations of the executive branch in any way, shape, or form is pretty damn exciting. I paged down one mouse wheel worth, and there was the chicken hawk from Merry Melodies pointing his finger at Foghorn Leghorn saying, yeah, the corrupt government needs a piece of paper from the corrupt government saying they can search your phone. Yeah, exactly. Oh, thank God the judges are here. Now their cause will have to be probable, right? Anyway. It's funny, I see, especially on Twitter, I see a lot of complaints about people not believing in the system. They don't believe in modern medicine. They don't believe in the police. They don't believe in the Congress. They don't believe in the way things are supposed to be. Everything's corrupt. Why would anyone believe in any of it? I mean, if your older brother is a doctor and he tells you, hey, look, man, this is a real thing and whatever, something, you might trust that. But I don't know. Within the last few years, it wasn't for my brain. But I met a neurologist who was like Cletus the slack-jawed yokel on The Simpsons. Complete cross-eyed, retard, mouth-breathing idiot. Neurologist. And I thought, wait a minute, don't I have to get a license from the other neurologists to be a neurologist or something? Oh, I guess that's the problem. They all liked her and thought, come on, let's be nice and give her her neurologist license or whatever. But brain scientist, this lady, really? Sorry, taking our business somewhere else. Everything is ridiculous and corrupt. Why would anyone have faith in the system when the checks and balances don't work? All the incentives are for people to keep doing the wrong thing all the time, in every way. You know, I sit here with CNN on mute and closed caption out of the left corner of my eye here during the show every day, as you can hear, and sometimes I pipe it in for you. And you know this, every prescription drug commercial is just some kind of baby boomer, just barely retired person living their life out sailboating with friends or participating in a charity, building a house for Habitat for Humanity or some kind of like weird fantasy thing that boomers don't actually do, but they think that maybe if they were healthy, they would leave the house and go do this thing. And it's all pushing whatever pill it is. And it's always just kind of this weird fantasy, this nonsense. And it's not even funny anymore. Every half-baked comedian in the world has already made the same joke. It's like men asking for directions or whatever. It's not even worth a chuckle at all about how the side effects are worse than the disease. Literally, arthritis medicine that causes cancer? Huh? Man, your wrists and fingers must really hurt like hell to take cancer to temporarily soothe your arthritis. Everything's corrupt. Nothing's worth believing in at all. The public debate about every issue is mired in dishonesty, in partisanship, and I mean that in the, not that I'm on one side and I don't like the other side way, but I mean that everybody's just so loyal to their side that they all hate the truth. They're at war with it all the time. All they want is power. All they want is to vanquish their enemies. All they want is to do the wrong thing. And then they get on Twitter and they complain that people just don't trust modern science to tell them that the oceans are going to wash them away, or that their vaccines are safe, or that the cops are going to protect you if you call them to help protect you. People don't believe it anymore. Why should they? None of it's true. And now we're not just stuck with Rather, Jennings, and Brokaw to tell us what we know. Genie's out of the bottle. Nobody believes in it because it ain't legit in the first place. That was hard for me. I remember when Bill Hicks first said this. He's a big influence on me, I admit. I remember the first time I heard him say that, listen, the reason that all of our institutions are crumbling is because they're no longer relevant. And I remember thinking, man, this society without the Constitution and without the Bill of Rights, and I still kind of think this, would be that much more out of control power. We wouldn't be rid of the government. We'd only be rid of the pretense of the restrictions that we hold against it at that point. But you can see that Bill Hicksian view has become the majority view now. It's time to scrap this whole mess. Right? Replace it with nothing. How about that?
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. You can find my blog and my bookstore and my stickers and my whole show archives and the chat room. All there at scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org/chat, if y'all want to hang out during the show. Jason Ditz is going to be on the show to talk about Israel a little bit later. And then also, as I said, Dar Jamil and Marcy Wheeler. But first up today is Michael Schwartz. And he's the author of a great book called War Without End about the Iraq War that was published, oh, back in, I don't know, 06 or 07 or something like that. And he's regular at TomDispatch.com. And he's got this new article at Tom Dispatch from 2 days ago. It's running today on antiwar.com as well. It's called The New Oil Wars in Iraq. And it's not some no blood for oil type thing. So don't get ahead of yourself, shaking your head and rolling your eyes. This is important. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Very good to have you back on the show. It's been way too long since we've spoken. And of course, I can tell, I forget now, it's been so long, but I can tell from this article that you certainly understand all the wide and varied reasons for the Iraq War, far beyond just, you know, kind of the mantra that, well, Houston just wanted to steal all the oil away, or that kind of thing.
Right.
Although whatever role that had in it, I'm happy to let you explain. I think that's a very interesting conversation in itself. But what this article is mostly about, and we've got time, what this article is mostly about is what role the oil plays and the oil money plays in the current conflict. And, of course, it's incredibly significant. So I guess, first of all, would you like to address what role oil had in the American intervention over there in the first place back? Well, not the first place, I guess the third place back in 2003.
Well, I mean, you know, everything is a long story. It's hard to make it short, but, you know, the geopolitics of what in those days was called the arc of instability, at least by the American administration, if you look at what the arc of instability was, it was also the arc of where the oil in the world was, 80% of the usable reserves. And the United States, like every other big power, had been trying to maneuver themselves into important positions in those areas for decades. Well, it's going on a century now, but in the you know, decades in the 90s. And Iraq became the central kind of place, the target, especially during the oil crisis in the 1990s, where it became the axial place. And all of the accoutrements around Saddam Hussein not just as a vicious dictator, which didn't seem to bother the American administrations much at all for most of the time, but rather as a kind of a, what they called a rogue, you know, who had designs on Kuwait's oil and in various ways was a wild card in the situation. And all this became focused way before 2001, really. In 1998 was the first sort of open call by, you know, high-level politicos for a U.S. military invasion of Iraq, a demand that Clinton responded to by initiating an air war against Iraq that was one of these quiet wars that nobody ever really reported on and did a lot of damage. And, of course, there were the sanctions against Iraq all during that period, which themselves did a lot of damage. So when 2001 comes, the key people in the Bush administration, Cheney and Rumsfeld would be probably the most critical of them, you know, immediately became focused on Iraq and said, you know, we needed to go in there and get control of this guy and get not control of the oil in the traditional sense, grab their oil and take it home, but rather in control of the oil in a less traditional sense, which is what got to be called the control of the spigot, which is that the amount of production in Iraq should be jacked up tremendously. And they have incredible reserves there. They might even have more reserves than Saudi Arabia. And so the idea would be, hey, you could kill three birds with one stone here. We can go in here. We can get rid of this rogue guy that we don't, you know, really is not part of the American, let's call it, sphere of influence the way, let's say, Saudi Arabia was. We can put a huge amount of pressure on Iran, which was kind of sworn enemy, and we can break OPEC into the bargain, because what we'll do is we'll just take all the oil fields in Iraq, we'll ship them out to various production companies, and jack up the oil production from 2,500 to 4,500 to 6,500 barrels per day. And ultimately, in their view, the chance, there was a real possibility of getting up to 12,500 per day and bring the price of oil down to about $20 a barrel. At that time, it was about 60. Now it's 90 and 100, and hasn't really been low ever since, which gives you a sense that that part of the goal was certainly not ever achieved.
Well, now, let me ask you about that, because it's Greg Palast's reporting that what happened there, what you're describing, is the neocon plan, as Elliot Cohen and others described it, as they wrote it up at the Heritage Institute, to, like you're saying, break Saudi control of OPEC and all that by dumping the price down to the floor. But then the way Palast has it is that finally James Baker got his way and said, oh, hell no. And isn't this funny, right? It's the former Trotskyite neoconservatives. They want to privatize all the oil. And the lawyer for all the capitalists back in Houston comes and says, oh, hell no, we're going to make this, same as always, a national Iraqi government oil company, and they're going to control it all, and they're going to keep this oil off the market and the price artificially high, because we like the Saudis and OPEC, because they always get along really well and work with Houston anyway. And so, you know, that was where, I think, the way Palast had it, where the Bakerites won over the neocons on that point back in 03 or 04.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Greg and I have read the same documents from the Baker Institute, and I have a slightly different reading of it, all that. But the plan that the Bakerites came out with, which they tried to implement, was to leave the oil, the national oil production, in the hands of the National Oil Company of Iraq, but to have all sorts of new exploration in Iraq, because there's the belief of the geologists is that they have 450 billion barrels of oil, a lot of it under Anbar province, and that the exploration would be given to international oil companies, and that the international oil companies would, of course, regulate production according to their market needs, and so both interests would be served at the same time. But it would also give the U.S., the international, let's call it the international community, because, of course, Europe had to be a partner in this, would be able to have another turn of the spigot, especially in light of the fact that the rate of increase of oil consumption was going up so dramatically that it was clear that the Saudis could not actually match the production levels that might be needed. So the Baker idea was to have a sort of half of both. One was not to keep them at 2.5 million barrels per day, but to get them up to about 4.5 million barrels per day, but then start really doing the exploration. So the oil piece underneath, right, was moving along, but of course all these plans, the neocons were far more ambitious and you know, far more unrealistic, because they really thought they were going to jack up production right away, pay for the, and use the increased revenues to pay for the war, which they thought would only cost $40 billion. And but even when they figured out it might cost $100 billion, they still thought they could pay for it with the oil.
Right. All right, but now we got to hold it right there, Michael, and go out to this break. Yeah. It's Michael Schwartz, everybody. He's author of the great book about the Iraq War, War Without End. Got that right. And he's at TomDispatch.com and Antiwar.com today. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right. We're back. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. I'm talking with Michael Schwartz, author of War Without End. And this piece at antiwar.com today, the new oil wars in Iraq. And now, a couple of things to get started on this segment. Michael, first of all, I believe I learned from Juan Cole, who you cite in another context in this article, I think. Well, in a slightly different context in this article. I believe that he said years ago, and I don't guess I ever really double-checked this, that under the predominantly majority Sunni parts of Iraq, there's really no oil. It's all up in the Kurdish region around Kirkuk and down near Basra, and that this was, I think he started telling me this back in 2004, this is one of the reasons that the Sunnis were absolutely fighting like hell to hold on to the state and hold on to the capital city against the assault of the U.S. Army and the Badr Brigade. You tell me who was working for who in that one. But anyway, and so, but now you just told me that the Baker Commission, or not the Baker Commission, but that's a different thing. The James Baker group, whatever, they had determined that they, or the geologists thought that there really was a ton of oil under Anbar. It just wasn't developed. Is that it?
That's what they think. Yeah, they do think so. And it's the whole, there's a lot of intrigue involved in that, because if you look at the oil geography, what Anbar, which is the key Sunni province, or the surrounding provinces around there, which are also majority Sunni, there's no oil, not none. That would be a complete exaggeration. There's, I think, 5% of the oil that's pumped currently in Iraq is in what the United States called the Sunni Triangle, the area of this of the country outside of Baghdad that is predominantly Sunni. 5%, 95% or about 80% is pumped in the Shia areas in the south around Basra, and the other 15% is pumped in Kirkuk, which is just outside of the Kurdish areas and which the Kurds claim, and inside the Kurdish areas. So there's very little oil being pumped there. The geologists say that the actual reserves of Iraq may be twice or 150 times the size of the current reserves that are proven, and that the bulk of those new reserves may well be under Anbar. So if they ever do develop the oil, it may turn out that the Sunnis are very oil rich. However, all that it would be in the future. In the current situation, there is plenty of oil around the Sunni areas, and that's very, very important. The main internal refinery is in a town called Baiji, and that's in a Sunni area. The only pipeline that leaves the country, goes through Anbar province. The rest of the oil leaves the country through the port in Basra. The Kurds are trying to organize export directly out of Kurdistan, and that's another source of tremendous tension in the country, because the Maliki government doesn't want them to have that independent source, because then they would lose control of the oil in Kurdistan areas. But and there's another refinery there. There's some small oil fields there, and so the people of the Sunni areas, number one, see the oil as a national treasure, not as as regional treasures to start with. And secondly, they see their part of it as something that certainly they should have some share of. So this has been going on for decades. Back under Saddam Hussein, for example, when the Sunnis were the favored group, right, because Saddam himself, it was a Sunni regime. And while it was, tremendous oppression of the Kurds and tremendous discrimination against Shia in that regime, the people in the Sunni areas were also deprived of many of the resources that the country should have had, not as bad as the other places. And they were protesting themselves and demanding more of the oil revenues that were financing the government. I mean, their government is not like the governments in Europe and so on, which, uses taxes as their revenue. These governments in the Middle East that are oil rich, the revenues of the of the Iraqi government have traditionally been over 95% just from the oil. And so they take all that revenue. The national government has all that revenue, right? And the question is, who's going to get what? And that is really the origins of this latest crisis, because when the Maliki regime took power and the United States removed itself and the oil production began to increase and the billions of dollars started flowing into the Maliki government that were presumably going to be used for rebuilding the country, somehow this money disappeared. It didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it went into probably quite a few Swiss banks. I mean, nobody has tracked all of it. The American contractors, while the U.S. was there, were getting billions and billions and billions of dollars for doing virtually nothing. I mean, there's one atrocity story after another around that. But once the U.S. left, everybody in the country expected to see the country start to rebuild quite rapidly, and it hasn't happened. But what really hasn't happened is that in the Sunni areas, they've seen nothing. In fact, they've seen continued decline. And so that's really the origin of this current crisis, because the people of these areas began protesting in various forms. You think of a protest and they've done it. They elected local governments. They elected provincial governments who made demands that, rebuilding be done, that their roads be fixed, that they stop having power only 2 hours a day, mm-hmm. that new facilities be there, or that the facilities that existed spread the electricity more efficiently, that the agricultural areas that were devastated be rebuilt, that the water in the rivers stop being polluted because the pollution coming in from upstream was destroying the fishing industry and the agricultural industry. I mean, these demands were made everywhere, and in the Sunni areas, the demands became more and more and more insistent. And eventually what Maliki decided was he really had to suppress this. And in the big high-profile moment, which is 3 years old now, he actually arrested one of the vice presidents, or he didn't arrest him. He indicted one of the vice presidents, the Sunni vice presidents, for terrorism because he was one of the point people for demanding that the oil revenues be shipped into the Sunni areas for rehabilitation and for jobs, government jobs, etc. And he's now a refugee from Maliki being harbored by the Kurds. He busted a lot of other Sunni leaders, and then the political leaders that were Sunni leaders started making themselves scarce. And so the protests moved into protests on the street. And then, of course, there started to be guerrilla war. And when that happened, Maliki shipped his army into the areas, and we're talking about a maturation of about a 2-year process of armed struggle there, into which this group that's it's called ISIS or ISIL, they still call it Al Qaeda, even though they've broken with Al Qaeda. This group is now one of the constituent parts. The American media tends to make them the only important actor, but they aren't not the most important actor. They are one of many parts, and they certainly are a vicious, horrible group who have ambitions to be really murderous, but they're often constrained by their allies and by the local guerrillas. Those have followed things closely. A lot of the local people are part of what the United States called the Sunni Awakening, which was a group of insurgents who, from the American point of view, switched sides. That is, they were fighting the Americans, and then they made a deal with the Americans to expel the jihadists. But the deal also included that the U.S. would withdraw their troops from Sunni communities all over Anbar and keep them in the bases. And so what in effect was that the insurgents in those areas then had the control of local politics, and that was the sort of consequences of the Sunni Awakening. Mm-hmm. But when Maliki came into power, he basically cut off the funds to all those groups so that those groups were no longer being funded out of the oil revenues. And so they have now turned back into insurgents, and they're really the backbone of what's gone on. And when you read in the paper that there are all these Baathists involved, yes, because they have been involved all along.
Right.
And
so now we're caught up. That's where we are today. I'm sorry we're all out of time, but thank you so much for getting us caught up, Michael. I appreciate it.
It's
so good stuff.
You know, and stay tuned. Stay tuned. There's much more to come, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's Michael Schwartz. He's at antiwar.com today, the new oil wars in Iraq. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
God dang, man. That was a pretty severe news episode right there, wasn't it? All right. I thought it was funny, you know, the first 15 seconds of it anyway.
All right. Well, whatever. Hey, Marcy Wheeler's coming up, and also Jason Ditz, and also Dar Jamil. Just hang tight. We got some other news to cover here first. Well, let me put off Iraq stuff because we got Iraq interviews coming up. There's other stuff I want to get out of the way here. I got to make sure and talk about. See, I'm going to talk with Marcy about that. Well, no. This I'm not. I try to get the ACLU today. I guess they're busy, but they got this new thing, War Comes Home, the excessive militarization of American policing. And, you know, if it's just in your heart and mind, then that's good. If you're into political expression of any kind, this is as important a cause to take up as any other thing. It's one of those deals when you're on that slippery slope, when things are already going so wrong, seems like we got to really pick and choose our battles here. And there's nothing more important than the turning of our local deputy sheriffs and our local city police into soldiers. And they always did beat the crap out of black people and kill them for fun and never get in trouble for it and all that. That's the history of America. But now it's getting at where they just kill them with rifles at distance. They come in homes in the middle of the night. They attack families. They're out of control. They treat America like it's Fallujah, like it's Iraq, and we're all just Hajis. And Lord knows they ain't got no rights. And so, you know, this is one of the things that got me interested in politics in the first place. You know, way back when I was young, way back before I could ever imagine what I might be able to ever do about it. Not that I can. Not that I've ever figured that out, really. But, it's very simple. You could be in high school, too, and understand very simply that at least supposedly and ostensibly, a cop's job is to protect the rights of criminal suspects. His job is taking you alive in order to protect your life from the townsfolk who would have you for the crime they all suspect you committed, apparently. And he'll hold you safe down in the jail where they can't get to you until you get your fair trial or, you know, bail you out, whatever, whatever. But that's the theory of policing, is that the accused have rights that must be protected. That if we left it up to the mob, we could not trust, or the aggrieved, we could not trust those rights to be protected. So supposedly we have to have this monopoly government with its institutions and its processes to inject a little bit of objectivity into the thing. But again, bottom line, you're born free. And just because somebody said you did something doesn't mean nothing. They've got to prove it. Innocent until proven guilty. Real kind of basic stuff like that. A soldier's job is to kill the enemy. To kill the enemy. You see how that's different? Putting firepower on target. Strap a JDAM to that bomb and drop it out the bay. Kill the people below with the high explosives. That is the job of the military. That is the job of a soldier. Not that I'm saying it should be. Of course, the U.S. has no actual enemies in the world that our government doesn't create for us one way or the other, so damn them.
Don't ever let them scare you into thinking you need them. But still, just basic level, you know? You could be just somebody's mom with no politics whatsoever and know that, hey, cops are supposed to be cops. And soldiers are soldiers, and that's different. Put it this way, would you have the Marine Corps standing guard at your local school, directing traffic, patrolling your neighborhoods? Those guys are dangerous, man. They're supposed to be dangerous. They are trained to kill people, not to protect them. They're trained to protect each other. But that ain't you. And this is just real simple. This isn't even government 101, okay? This is the kind of stuff that little kids are supposed to learn about America from the time they're in kindergarten. What makes us better than fascist, Nazi, communist, totalitarian countries, or third world, tribal, theocratic hellholes? Because we believe in liberty. That's what. And now look at this. Your local deputy sheriff. I told you about the kook next door. I usually don't talk about myself, but I found all this stuff out. Well, not, you know, I don't know. I guess I kind of do sometimes. I found this out during the show that the cops were next door because the guy was like the worst episode of Hoarders ever and apparently was killing the animals in the neighborhood, which means he probably murdered my cat. Remember that? A few weeks back, whatever, whatever. Well, the two Austin City Police who were just standing around out front of the house later on in that afternoon were wearing what goes under the full SWAT uniform, right? They're not wearing the full Darth Vader, but they're wearing all black. They're not wearing slacks. They're wearing cargo pants, right? Whatever, you know, military style pants with along with a shirt that is much more like fatigues than a blouse. And I'm sure they had M16s in the trunk of their car and all that too, whatever. But anyway, these are not the SWAT guys. These are just the plain old cops, and they don't wear blue anymore. They don't wear anything like a civilian security guard uniform anymore. They dress like soldiers now. And that's the same in my town as it is in your town. And it's absolutely out of control. And who supports this other than the cops themselves? Who is for this other than the guy, the companies manufacturing the tanks and the machine guns for them to use against us? When the crime rate has plummeted. And when every time a reporter asks a cop to make a statement to try to justify this kind of thing, they go completely off the deep end into crazy conspiracy theory land. My favorite one, and this keeps getting quoted, is the cop in Indiana who says the soldiers are coming home from war, and then immediately he turns them into the Sunni insurgency. He turns them into the Taliban, them into ISIS. The soldiers are coming home from the war, and they know how to make IEDs and defeat law enforcement techniques, so we have to arm up to be prepared to deal with them. What? Was that in the Be All You Can Be commercial? Join up for the service. When you come home, the cops are going to be so terrified of you that they're going to kill you at the first possibility. They're going to consider you a terrorist because they're going to be making up excuses for why they need a tank, and you're going to be the best that they can come up with. Hoorah! Fighting for our freedom, you're the excuse for all of our freedom to be destroyed. Get that? The government made you a trained killer, and now they're afraid of you. And now they're turning the local cops into soldiers like you to protect themselves from you and making all of us the victims. Thanks a lot for your service to our country. Oh, thank you for your service. You didn't do any good at all, only bad. But thank you. Thank you for militarizing America. Thank you for destroying secularism in Arabia, in the Middle East altogether. Thank you for wasting $5 trillion. Thank you for destroying the economy, for being what the economy was destroyed, wasting money on. Now the only place you can find a job is at the local police department. That's the next civil war. The war veterans who join the police forces versus the war veterans who they do SWAT raids against all day, every day, because they're so terrified of them, because now they're all a bunch of Sunni insurgents with IEDs. Anyway, join up the ACLU, join up the Rutherford Institute if you lean right, get with anything that you can do to oppose this publicly in America right now. It's worth it. ACLU's new report is War Comes Home.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. In just a minute, Dar Jamil is going to be on to talk about Iraq. Jason Ditz will be on to talk about what's going on in the West Bank. I'm sorry, I've been so far behind on that, man. I just don't have time to read, and I don't know, but... anyway, Jason's going to be on to teach us what the hell. And Marcy Wheeler's going to be back on the show, too. All right, so, man, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to spend that whole segment talking about how I wanted to get the ACLU on the show to talk about this thing. War Comes Home. It's really important. And here's something at news.mic. M-I-C, mic, like this kind of mic. News.mic. Oh, it's just mic.com. Wow, how'd you get that URL? The U.S. is spending billions to fight a pointless war, and it's not in Iraq or Afghanistan. And, oh, here, it's about the ACLU report. He says, while SWAT teams were originally meant for riot control and active shooter situations, the study found that 62% of SWAT missions were actually drug searches, with 79% of raids involving private homes. Only 7% of raids lined up with how SWAT teams were intended to be used. Yeah, call it mission creep. And anyway, so I'm glad that ACLU didn't get back to me today, because I want to really try to take a look at this report and read as much of it as I can, so that I can ask good questions. all right, so, yeah, get to that. Now, let me see here. Oh, I gotta try to remember to talk with Dar Jamil about the suicide bombings in Lebanon. I think pretty much every day for the last week or so. And now, I don't think that the ISIS guys really have a direct path to move en masse to Lebanon. Assad government is still in their way as of right now. But they can get suicide bombers in. Big part of their break with Zawahiri is what border? Go back to the Iraq side of the border. Why, we don't know what border you might be referring to. What a sellout you are if you think that there's a border there. It's gone now. The new Islamic State, it's still a proto-state, I guess, but they seem to be getting the work done. I did read this one article that said that Nusra was a lot better at hearts and minds than ISIL or ISIS, that they still probably will blow up their own respectability and credibility, whatever legitimacy they have gained so far. Which... God, I hope so. Pretty much counting on it. But, yeah, so for them, Lebanon's next, and then Jordan, and then Israel. Why not? And what was it that I read? You know, I think it was this thing I read in Politico magazine, but it seemed like it was pretty damn good, man. Long-form journalism. I meant to send it off to David Enders and ask him what he thought of it or something, you know, because there was a lot of independent reporting in there that I just don't know enough about to confirm or not, or to really know whether it seems like it's really right to me or not. Seemed like really good stuff. And I'm pretty sure it was in there that she says that they've been working on it anyway, on putting sleeper cells in the refugee camps in Jordan and trying to get people, I guess, into the West Bank. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I think for a time, this will be something that I need to ask Jason. One of the accusations was that it was ISIS guys that kidnapped the kids in the West Bank as a provocation. I guess we'll see. But, yeah, this thing is not over yet. Let's think about that. Again, that James Baker quote. I told him not to do that. You know what, James? We all did, and a lot of us, you know, were a lot more clear on the concept than you, dude. He wanted a coup, not an invasion that put the Shiites in charge. He wanted another Sunni Baathist general in charge. Stability. Not this madness. Not this fevered dream turned into the world's worst nightmare. And then, all right, so, well, hell, I got all this stuff I can talk about with Dar, too. He's coming on. So let me move on to Taliban launch major offensive in Afghanistan in the Helmand province. Much of the fighting is located in the Sengen district. Thousands of civilians fleeing. This is today, the 25th of June, 2014, at WallStreetJournal.com. Online.wsj.com. Kabul, the Taliban have launched a major offensive in Afghanistan's southwestern Helmand province. Afghan officials said, massing hundreds of fighters in an attempt to seize ground from government forces as U.S. and international forces depart. Much of the fighting, Afghan and coalition officials said, was concentrated in Sangin district on the eastern edge of the province. Last summer, the Taliban pushed to take control of Sangin, I guess, taking over several police checkpoints before Afghan security forces recaptured them. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I guess they still have American air power, but they don't have the American army on the ground to fight this battle for them. So y'all want to place your bets on the Afghan army? I wonder if we're really going to see a Saigon moment with people hanging onto the skids of the helicopters taking off from the roof of the embassy in Kabul and that kind of thing. Yep. Oh, just wait till Jeb comes. We'll reinvade. Or Hillary, either way. And then, oh, here was a, no, that was the Jordan thing again. Oh, the drone memo, no, I'm going to talk about that with Marcy. Oh, and then the Greenwald thing, nah, I mentioned this yesterday. Greenwald says the news story is imminent, and apparently it's not going to be a long list of people. I don't know, maybe that will be part of it. Apparently, though, I'm not on it. Whew. I mean, I'm kind of disappointed, but then again, okay, you know, I prefer not being persecuted, actually. Because he said he's contacted everybody on the list, and some of them have wished to remain redacted and silent because they fear blowback, even though they're innocent. Others want to be part of the discussion, have been interviewed, so this is going to be a major story that comes out here. And he said to Shepard Smith, well, here, let's cue it up and listen to the last little part of what he said. And then, oh, yeah, the VA scandal. We're going to get to that VA thing here again pretty soon. I think it's the last little part of this conversation.
And the GCHQ, we have never lost control of a single document. We've been extraordinarily careful with how we've managed this information.
And when you publish this information, will it come out in a newspaper, and then what happens next?
Yeah, it'll come out at the Intercept.
Have you talked to any of these people who've been targeted or the kinds of people who've been targeted?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons it took so long is because we're not going to expose people as being NSA targets who don't want to be exposed. And there are people who don't want to be exposed, even though they think it was invalid because they feel it'll harm their reputation or compromise their privacy. But all the people who on whom we're reporting consented to it. They participated in the story. They spoke on camera. We're publishing video.
Man, I wonder if Dar Jamail is one of them.
Definitely recognize some of these names.
He's coming up next on the show. Hang tight, y'all.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I've got the great Dar Jamail on the line here. Author of Beyond the Green Zone, former unembedded soldier from George W. Bush's Iraq War. I know Bush Sr., Bill Clinton had their own wars. Obama's now got his own Iraq War, too. So we got to differentiate which Iraq War we're talking about. Ronald Reagan had his own, only he was on Saddam's side. Anyway, welcome back to the show. I know that you're beat nowadays. You're trying to find peace and do some environmental work, and it's important journalism, I'm sure. But I need your expertise on the war here, Dar. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. And I am going to be writing about Iraq again, so it's inevitable.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, Michael Hastings is dead, and Robert Dreyfus won't do radio anymore, and there just ain't too many people who ever heard of Abdelaziz al-Hakim or know anything about what the hell, you know, actually happened in this damn war. You know, everybody's got some myth that they need to cling to for whatever stupid explanation. So, you know, trying to find people who actually understand and are willing to just give the straight dope the best that they can. You guys are few and far between, and you're one of the best, of course. So thanks again. So tell me, let's start with Kurdistan. Is this the end of Kurdistan's alliance with Baghdad? Is it the end of Kurdistan being part of an Iraqi state, do you think?
It's certainly heading in that direction. I mean, you know that U.S. policy in Iraq is in dire straits when you have Kerry asking the Kurds to help hold Iraq together. I mean, that is extremely telling comments. But, you know, the reality is the Kurds have been planning on trying to become an autonomous state since the second talk of U.S. invasion began back in 2001. And so they've been planning for this, and they are seizing this opportunity the best they can. It's, of course, complicated because Kurdistan has still very, very strong economic ties on Baghdad. They do remain reliant on Baghdad for a lot of their building materials in this sort of thing. But, you know, this rift has been happening. And Scott, I know that you've talked about it on your shows over the last years, too. I mean, we don't have to go back too far. But back in 08, 09, there were major rifts between Baghdad and Kurdistan. And at one point, Maliki even deployed a large portion of the Iraqi military up to the border of Kurdistan when Kurdistan was at that point threatening to start selling their oil on their own terms and leaving Baghdad out of it. So this is a very, very real rift that's almost come to blows in the past. And now the Kurds are basically seizing the opportunity to pull further away from Baghdad. And at this point, Baghdad literally can't do anything about it. I mean, they literally have Maliki has his hands full just trying to keep Baghdad at this point from being taken over by rebels and ISIS.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the Kurds got their hands full just keeping ISIS out of Kurdistan. Although, as the war nerd Gary Brecher has written today, the Kurds have the benefit of topography for actual natural border for much of their territory from the flat desert land where ISIS is prevailing for now. So, and of course, the Peshmerga are the most professional military force in the country and have been for a long time.
and the most cohesive. I mean, because even Iraqi's military, as we're, you know, this ISIS crisis is underscoring, as have previous crises underscored, that the Maliki military is essentially a mercenary first force whose loyalties are secondarily at best to the government in Baghdad. I mean, when we saw Maliki deploy the military against the Sadr Mahdi army down in southern Iraq several years ago, we literally had instances where people in the military just started walking over to the Sadr side because, lo and behold, they're part of the Mahdi army, and they were just in the Iraqi military to get the extra paycheck or to pick up some extra gear. So that type of situation is rampant, and we're seeing it all over even now, where, you know, when this crisis first began, when ISIS rolled into Mosul and most of the Iraqi army just left, there was actually very little fighting, but by comparison to how many folks were there, and they basically just either turned tail or ran to Baghdad or just ran back to their home village, wherever that was. So again, the fact that the Kurds are organized, they're coherent, they have a structurally sound military, their loyalties are very, very clear. So that's yet another leg up that they have, both over ISIS and Maliki's military.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so there were all these initial reports when the latest phase of this started back up again that, well, you know, as soon as ISIS rolled into Mosul, the Kurds took Kirkuk. Well, it was already their city, and they had been kicking all the Arabs out since, 2003 at least. And it's certainly a majority Kurdish city, and the Peshmerga already controlled it, right? What exactly, if anything, changed in the status of Kirkuk? Did they actually consolidate their power over the city more than it was before?
I wouldn't go quite that far, simply because it's still technically a contested city. I mean, it's very unstable. Certainly, most of what you said is true. I mean, they already had control of it. They were already doing things from early on in the U.S. occupation, like teaching Kurdish in the schools instead of Arabic, pulling down Arabic signs, replacing them with Kurdish signs. So already they were quick to pounce on Kirkuk once the invasion occurred in 2003, and those policies were moving forward from that point on and well advanced in before this crisis even began. But now we have a situation where the Kurds, I mean, at least for now, ISIS has kind of surrendered Kirkuk and not tried to make a play for it, but nevertheless taken over Beji, you know, the biggest oil refinery in the country, which is very nearby there. Of course, they have total control of Mosul, which is also not too far from there. So I think it's safe to say that while Kirkuk is largely in control of the Kurds, the situation is far from settled.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, another thing that Gary Brecher wrote about was all the refugee minorities, the Yazidis and the Turkmen and the Assyrian and Chaldean Christians and all these others who've been hiding out in the foothills of in Kurdistan, in Kurdish territory, but how these are just low-hanging fruit targets for a bunch of ISIS lunatic beheaders who would, you know, crucify them upside down if they could and all this kind of crap. So that's a conflict, the way he portrays it, one that's waiting to still play itself out.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, the situation across most of Iraq at this point is so incredibly volatile and it's so intensely dynamic that, we don't know what it's going to look like. There's no predicting where this is going to go. I mean, literally as we speak, you know, the ISIS and the people affiliated with them are encircling Baghdad. And so what happens then if they cut supplies to Baghdad?
By the way, are you referring to this piece by Mitchell Prothero today in McClatchy about them seizing the highway south of Baghdad? Is that what you're talking about? Or is there more?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm trying to get a hold of him and it ain't working. But and he says he has Kurdish sources for that. And you know, he's a damn good reporter. But I wonder, is that smart of the ISIS guys to try to do that? How in the world could they hold a highway south of Baghdad unless, what, the Mahdi army's all on vacation in the Bahamas or what?
That's a good question, Scott.
I mean, the Iraqi army, I guess, you know, when they're the bottom brigade, they're ruthless killers. When they're the Iraqi army, they sit in their lounge chairs and collect their tax money. Okay, that makes sense to me. But the Mahdi army is still a very well-motivated and disciplined militia. So how could it be that the ISIS guys could be reaching to the south and to the east of Baghdad? Ah, crap, and now the music's playing and we got to go to break. If you can answer it quick, try.
I'll wait till we come back.
Oh, well, and you're one of those that the music is stomping right on your signal. I'm not sure why it happens to some Skype callers and not others. We're going to work that out. Anyway, it's the great Darja Mail, everybody. We're going to be right back right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to The Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back. Marcy Wheeler's coming up. Jason Ditz, too. Right now, we're talking with Darja Mail, author of Beyond the Green Zone. Writes for, I had some search results for your name a minute ago. Where do you write for mostly now, Dar? Oh, I hit the wrong button. So now answer. Sorry. Try again.
Oh, hey, Tom. Hey there. Yeah, right now I'm writing, I'm a staff reporter for Truth Out, but also writing sometimes for Tom Englehart.
Oh, there you go. Great. Yeah, we love Tom Englehart, man. All right. Good deal. All right, now, so when we were interrupted by the break, I was asking, could it really be that the ISIS guys have now moved to the south and to the east of Baghdad, and is it really right that they're attempting to cut off the capital city from the rest of southern Iraqi Shiistan that George Bush created?
It is. I mean, whether this holds or continues to increase is really, I think, the big question. But, when we talk about ISIS, one thing, and I know that you know this, Scott, but just to make it clear to more of the listeners, you know, we're not talking only about ISIS. ISIS now includes a large part of the former Iraqi resistance that formed under the U.S. occupation. Mm-hmm. And it also is including a lot of the old Ba'athist military leaders. And these are people who are seasoned fighters, seasoned military strategists that fought all through the Iraq-Iran war. They then helped form the backbone of the Iraqi resistance and made it as effective as it was at times against the U.S. military. And now they are flocking in and joining in the battle, not necessarily with ISIS, although that's happening some, but it's certainly alongside. I mean, the ISIS moves have been a rallying cry for the disenfranchised Sunni, and that's why they're getting so much support across Iraq. And then, of course, when there's blood in the water, it becomes even more frenetic. And so you have the Sunnis who've been literally persecuted, detained, tortured, shot, unarmed civilian protesters shot and killed all through 2013. And so when they have a chance now to take the fight back to Baghdad and take the fight directly to Maliki and forces under his control, that's what we're seeing. And that's why this movement is as widespread and as strong and powerful as it is. It's not just 3,000 to 5,000 to 10,000 Sunni extreme Islamic radicals. It's now that plus what I just discussed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they're like in South Park. They're the darky shield. You radicals, you go out there and catch the first volley of bullets headed our way. But yeah, like you're saying, I mean, the reason that it's or what you're saying, I think, is why it's been, pardon me, but relatively bloodless advance when you look at the amount of territory that has joined the uprising here, that is, is declaring itself independent from Baghdad, or, you know, maybe marching on Baghdad soon enough. I don't know. But it was easy to take these cities for the most part. And there's been relatively little fighting because, like you're saying, these are the areas where Maliki's got no support whatsoever. Now, I don't guess Sada really supports Maliki very much and hasn't wanted to support him for a very long time. And I don't know whether, well, but then again, Sistani said you know, to fight against these guys, to fight against the Sunnis, you ought to join the Iraqi army. He didn't say go join Sadr's Mahdi army. He said join the Iraqi army. So I don't know, you know, exactly who's going to be doing the fighting on that side. But I guess that's why I'm kind of surprised to hear that they would be really pushing on Baghdad, because it seems like that's really stupid. Because, you know, if the Iraqi army is going to turn and run back to Baghdad, Baghdad is what they'll stand and fight for, if anything. And certainly, you know, the Mahdi army is based right there in eastern Baghdad. So it's not like they're going to let these guys push it this far. And ISIS has been pretty smart, right? They tell al-Nusra, you guys go die in trying to fight in Damascus or whatever the hell. We're going to consolidate the territory we've got so far. And so why in the world would they suicidally fling themselves up against the walls of Baghdad, which they've already lost?
Well, that's a good point, and maybe they're not going to. I mean, maybe they are just trying to isolate it. Maybe this is, I mean, we don't know. I mean, these are seasoned military strategic commanders that are now in the game on the ground that are taking part in this uprising. And so maybe it's a bluff. Maybe it's a temporary show of force. I mean, maybe it's a false flag that they're going to do and to distract and then make a push someplace else. We just don't know. But another point, a point that you brought up that I think is important about why is Sadr not being involved, because, you know, down there in Hilla, that is his home turf, you know, that along with Sadr City and Baghdad, of course. And why is he? And I think something you said actually really does shed light on why Sadr is, at least for now, standing down. And that's because Sistani is allied directly with Maliki, and Maliki obviously directly with Sistani. And so when Sistani calls on people to go join the Iraqi army, I mean, once again, as we've seen consistently, Sadr is disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not being included in that. And I think, again, like he did smartly and strategically throughout the U.S. occupation, is when he felt it was the right time to fight and that the Mahdi army was at an advantage, then they would fight.
Yeah. But they had some huge parade last weekend, right? Tens of thousands of fighters marching with new weapons, and they're sure are ready for battle. I don't know where they want to do it, but...
A very effective show of force, but clearly they're standing down. Clearly they're waiting and standing aside and waiting for their time, because, you know, Sadr definitely has the numbers. Sadr definitely has the guys on the ground. That's been the case through the very beginning of the U.S. occupation. I mean, a massive, massive militia, possibly even the biggest one in the entire country outside of the Peshmerga. And so, again, he's clearly standing down for whatever reason. I mean, that's something that I'll need to look more into as I go forward with my writing. But that's, again, and as you know, and as we've talked about on your show over the years, Sadr has this penchant for being able to throw a wrench into the game at exactly the worst possible time for everyone else. So maybe that's what he's waiting for right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had one of his guys announce last week that, hey, Americans, you'll still be considered occupiers and your lives forfeit, so don't come back. And these are the guys we're fighting for.
Right, right. And I mean, that's another interesting point, Scott. I mean, I think we should talk about what is the U.S. role now. Is there really a possibility that the U.S. would send back in a large number of troops? I really can't see that happening. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, well, they're sending in these so-called advisors, and this is what they did when they started to build things up for Vietnam. But I politically just cannot see that happening at this point, unless it appeared as though Baghdad was really going to fall completely. And as we just discussed, I don't really think that's possible right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish I agreed with you about that, but I just cannot see. And it may take a little while. I forgot if we joked before about how it's this Israel first policy that has the myth that ISIS ain't so bad compared to Assad going on the other side of the former border there. And so the narrative is confused from the war party's perspective. They can't put out a coherent thing about the enemy needs fighting over there. They need a simpler narrative to sell. But I think that's going to fall away. that Netanyahu first narrative is going to fall away, and eventually they're going to have to grapple with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria as a real place. And then I think that the politics of empire are just, you know, I don't know what we can do to stop them, man. I want to try to stop them with as many radio shows I can do, whatever the hell, I don't know. But it just seems like the logic of empire is that, as Barack Obama said in his statement the other day, we cannot allow there to be a safe haven. Well, George Bush created a safe haven in 2003. The only way really to stop that is to put the Marine Corps there. And of course, that just makes it worse. But I mean, from the empire's point of view, what can you do except send in Marines and planes and drones and killers to kill? And I don't know what's going to stop them. You know, and I think it's the supreme irony that it's basically treason on behalf of Israel that has our government backing Al-Qaeda in Syria against Israel's enemy, Assad, that is really preventing the war from getting worse at this point.
That's right. That's right. And those are all really good points, Scott. I think, though, that things would have to get they're catastrophic in Iraq right now, but I think even that said, they would have to become so, so much worse for the U.S. to begin deploying a large number of troops needed to stem this, which obviously would have to be a very, very large number.
Well, and it would just make matters worse, too. It would be exactly, and I think this is back to what's going on at the highway near Baghdad there. Well, what would Zarqawi do? Zarqawi would set off a bomb in the Shiite marketplace and kill a bunch of kids and provoke a worse conflict. And I think that, you know, ought to be anticipated as their strategy against the Shiites, against the U.S., against Iran, and whoever they can, too. And man, I wish we didn't. You know what? We don't have to go. I'm just going to turn this down and keep recording you for a minute because the archives are going to hear it. We'll be right back, everybody, in just a minute. That's the thing is, I think that, I'm not trying to endorse intervention. I'm just saying from the Empire's point of view, I think they're going to have to. But I think that's got to be exactly what these kooks want, is to bring the Americans back in there and recruit that many more people to their cause.
It is, which interestingly enough is exactly what bin Laden wanted, was to have the U.S. send its military overseas to plop down in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq or someplace else, and then they can just be bled. I mean, that's what happened to the Russian military in Afghanistan, and that's what's happened to the U.S. in Afghanistan and now Iraq. And absolutely, it is the single biggest recruiting tool at this point. I mean, it's not that they need more motivation on the ground. Those in ISIS are those fighting alongside them now. But now to introduce another U.S. Military presence, I can't imagine a better recruiting tool. And they don't even need one right now. I mean, literally, this is, as you talked about, this is exactly why they've been so successful, because of the U.S. backing of Maliki. So even just from indirect U.S. Government presence and policy in the region by backing a Shia Saddam like Nouri al-Maliki, we're seeing things completely go into meltdown. And so it's hard to even imagine what it would look like and what would unravel if the U.S. started sending military in there, which is another reason I think. I mean, it's complex, right? Because you make really good points, but at the same time, that is another reason why it's really hard to imagine the U.S. sending more troops in there any more than they have thus far.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think no one better ever stopped them is the problem here. I mean, we basically have a consensus in the country, more or less, that even if they don't put it this way in the polls or whatever, that Ron Paul was right, that actually, yeah, it does make sense that we pick this fight by messing around over there, and that now we just keep making matters worse and worse, and we ought to back off. I think kind of everybody understands blowback now. It's a household word now, but still, you know, didn't keep them out of Libya. You know, hasn't kept them from backing ISIS in Syria for the last 3 years, you know, indirectly, but not very indirectly, for the last 3 years. So, I don't know, but I'm a damn pessimist. I'm glad to hear you knowing better than me and in a more optimistic kind of a way there as far as the American response here.
Well, even at that, Scott, gosh, I couldn't even say it, because you made a really important point earlier too, talking about the total lack of coherence in the U.S. policy. On the one hand, they're being pulled one direction by corporate power. On another hand, they're being pulled in a distinctly different direction from Israeli policy. In another hand, there are the realists in the military or in the State Department that are looking at what's happening and wanting us to do a different thing. So literally being pulled in different directions. And that's why I think it appears as total chaos and very confusing from a U.S. policy perspective, because that's exactly what it is. I think they in a lot of ways, they don't know what to do. And in other ways, even if they did know what to do, are they going to be allowed to do it because of all the different interests and in the directions that the U.S. government is being pulled?
Yep. All right. Well, I'll let you go with that. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Dar. We got to keep doing this all the time now.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. That's Dar Jamail, everybody. He wrote Beyond the Green Zone. And was it? Are you there? Is it Winter Soldier?
The Will to Resist.
The Will to Resist. Winter Soldier is Aaron Glantz. I just confused those two. The Will to Resist. Thanks very much, Dar, again.
Thanks.
Oops. And then, yeah, so we'll be right back.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys. Well, CNN has decided they're going to talk about some guy left his kid in the car all day now. Breaking news, some guy is being charged with leaving his kid in the car, and the kid died. It's a global news story all day today on CNN because there's nothing more important going on that you need to know about. Got that? Okay, good. Now on to Jason Ditz to talk about stuff that matters. He's the news editor at news.antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I really appreciate you coming on short notice and all this. I got so much to talk to you about, and most I want to talk about what's going on in Israel, which I'm way behind on. But first of all, I got to talk about the top headline here, because I never did get a chance to talk about it with Dar, and it's such an important thing here, and I actually should have hit refresh, because maybe worse has happened. But the top headline on antiwar.com is, I think, officials, Syrian airstrikes kill 57 Iraqi civilians. The Syrians are now bombing ISIS in Iraq, or at least ISIS targets, inside Iraq. Is that right?
Right. They launched airstrikes against a few towns, mostly border towns, but all of them in the Anbar province that are under ISIS control. But it doesn't sound like they really hit anything of ISIS's in those attacks. The attacks ended up killing at least 57 civilians, wounding another 120. Mostly they went after marketplaces that they thought were arms bazaars. Syria's denying that any of the slain were civilians, but of course that's what they always say.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they openly accept responsibility for the attacks, though, in the first place? Did they make a show of it? In fact, is what I'm more curious about, is whether they kind of announced it or not.
It's sort of weird. I mean, the Syrian state media reported the airstrikes yesterday as, okay, Syrian airstrikes happened according to Iraqi officials. But they never got any official comment from the Syrian government, which, you know, Sana'a is the Syrian state media is run by the Syrian government, so it's bizarre that they wouldn't have at least some official position on it.
Yeah. Well, they let it run, at least it's what they would have us believe, I guess, would be my interpretation of that. So, or at least the PR department. I don't know how well coordinated it all is. But now, so what makes it a big deal to me is that it's a PR stunt, right? This is Assad's way, and of course he just butchers a bunch of innocent people in order to do it. But it's his way of making the point that he's on America's side and Maliki's side in the new Iraq war, right?
Right, and Iraq and Syria have been coordinating in the past over the past few weeks about the strikes along the border on each side of the border, but officials say it's not clear if these specific attacks were discussed beforehand, which it seems like they would have been, because that seems like a huge deal to cross the border, even though in practice that border doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Well, actually, even without the phone call, I think Assad could probably count on Maliki nodding and smiling. And yeah, I mean, Joe Biden and John Kerry have been crying for 2 years, 3 years, that, hey, Maliki, stop helping Iran arm and fund Hezbollah and Syria, please. Ever since George Bush put Iraq in that Shiite crescent where it didn't used to belong. Anyway. What a disaster. Okay, now to the West Bank. Israeli settlers' children were kidnapped. Correct? How many? How long ago? Who's got them? And what all has happened since?
Well, it's been a couple of weeks now. Three teenagers, one of them was an American citizen, too. Three Israeli teenagers, though, one of them I believe was dual citizenship, were kidnapped somewhere. It's not entirely clear where. The group claiming responsibility for it calls itself ISIS of Palestine and has been handing out leaflets insisting they did it. But Israel has sort of said, well, we don't really think these guys did it for some reason. First they were blaming Hamas. Then they were saying, well, the Palestinian Authority in general is responsible for it. There were times in the Israeli parliament where they were blaming John Kerry, saying if he hadn't forced us into peace talks, none of this would have happened. But the responsibility has been... the response from Israel has been insane. I mean, a huge military operation.
Well,
in the West
Bank. Hang on, let me stop for a second. As far as the whodunit, is there any indication of whodunit at all? Does it sound credible to you that maybe it was some new group? I mean, it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that Abbas would have done. And I don't know if Hamas, Abbas being the head of the Palestinian Authority, I don't know if Hamas has really any presence on the West Bank at all, do they?
They have some, but very limited presence, and it wouldn't seem like the sort of thing they would do right now. I mean, of course, Hamas has done kidnappings in the past when it stood to gain them something, but right now, having just formed a unity government with Fatah, they're pretty close to elections. This seems like it would hurt them more than help them, and it's one of those cases, we see it all the time in the Gaza Strip, too, where some nothing group fires a couple of rockets that land in a field in Israel. Hamas goes and tries to arrest them, and then Israel bombs a Hamas-run police station or something in retaliation.
Right.
Because they say, well, it's their fault.
Yeah, well, and more about that in the next segment, because that's been happening in Gaza here. But now, okay, so... But now, as far as the whodunit, no real indication of who. It could just be any old, you know, group of two or three people who did it, right?
Right.
Is that all anybody knows?
Israel hasn't provided any evidence to suggest Hamas did it. This other group that insists it did it hasn't provided any evidence that they have those kids. So it really could be about anybody.
All right. And then, so now the response.
Okay, well, the response has been insane. Israel's mobilized a bunch of troops in the West Bank nominally looking for these kids, but they've killed at least five Palestinian civilians. They've arrested hundreds of people without charges on the notion that they might conceivably be connected to a kidnapping. It doesn't seem like any of them knows anything, or at least what Israel has indicated is they don't have any new leads.
Are they just going house to house on these raids? I mean, I've seen on Twitter where everybody's house is just completely ransacked and they post it up. It's amazing, 2014. You know, they post up their ransacked living room in the you know, on the West Bank there. Are they just doing this to everybody?
Well, it seems like they're hitting areas around where the teenagers were likely at when they disappeared, and just arresting random people to see if they know something. I mean, that's the impression I get. They're not arresting people who have known ties to any group where they might possibly know something. It seems like they're just grabbing whoever might have heard something.
Crazy. And now you say hundreds have been arrested, huh?
Yeah, it's in the hundreds. The exact figure, I'm not sure. I believe it was 215 a couple of days ago. I'm not sure if that's changed.
All right. Okay, now, when we get back, I want to ask you, Jason, a bit about what's been going on in the Gaza Strip. And I admit I'm cheating by using you here. I have not been doing my homework, but I did see something about some airstrikes in Gaza, for all I know, in the name of this kidnapping in the West Bank. I don't know, but I'm going to ask you here in a minute. It's Jason Ditz. He's news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Back in a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Ditz. He's the news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. And man, I screwed up, Jason. I meant to ask you about Israel's strikes on Syria after Syria's strikes on Iraq in order to juxtapose whose daylight is between what interest over there and all that kind of thing. Can you please fill us in before we switch back to the Gaza Strip here?
Oh, sure. Well, a couple of days ago, there was an incident along the, I guess you'd call it the frontier in the Golan Heights between the Israeli-occupied portion and the Syrian portion. An anti-tank missile was fired across into the Israeli side and hit a civilian car and killed a 15-year-old.
Any indication of what kind of anti-tank missile that might have been?
There really wasn't. And that's sort of an unusual thing. I mean, of course, there's always stray fire back and forth across that border. But Israel immediately blamed the Syrian military for this and launched airstrikes on 9 different targets across southern Syria, killed 10 soldiers and wounded several others, destroyed one of the military bases there. But the bizarre thing is, why would Syria's military fire a random anti-tank missile at a random passenger car near the frontier? And why would they do it particularly at a time where groups like ISIS and all of these other Syrian rebel groups are bragging about all the U.S.-made anti-tank missiles that they've gotten a hold of?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. It's not the kind of thing we'd run at antiwar.com, but there was a thing at the Long War Journal where they were saying that, well, I may be putting words in their mouth a little bit, but it sure seemed to me between the lines like they were saying that the so-called Islamic Front is just a name for the procurement arm, the new name for the procurement arm of the al-Nusra Front, and that they had to call themselves something else when they walk up to the CIA agents and ask for money and guns. And but that really, you know, whatever TOW missiles the FSA and the Islamic Front were getting were ending up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front immediately.
Oh,
as those sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Certainly. recently, and these, I mean, this has been happening for a long time, since the U.S. started arming any Syrian rebels, even when they were just arming the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, which is supposedly the secular group. The weapons were showing up in the hands of basically everybody. Once arms show up in the country, they pretty quickly get scattered around among all the rebel groups. And ISIS, which is, of course, the big one, has not only what weapons they've managed to secure out of the U.S. shipments to Syria, they've also looted an enormous number of U.S. weapons in Iraq as they've taken over Iraqi military bases.
Including Blackhawks, which, you know, I guess if they're working with the Baathists, they could well have people who could fly those things and use them.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, we haven't seen any Blackhawks show up anywhere on the battlefield yet fighting for ISIS, but we have seen a lot of Humvees and a lot of armored personnel carriers and things like that sort of.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect the ISIS coops to. I wouldn't expect the ISIS guys to be able to fly a Black Hawk, but I bet there could be some Baathist officers who could, you know?
Oh, sure.
All they need is the internet for the instruction manual, download it right into their brain like on the movies, and study for a little while is what I mean to say. Can't be that hard. They're made by monkeys for other monkeys to fly, so.
All right, they'll figure it out.
Yeah. All right, well, so, God, what a damn mess over there. So, in the same collective punishment sort of sense, we got to switch the topic back to the prisoners of the Gaza Strip, most of whom are under the age of 18. Tell us what's going on over there these days.
Well, what's going on in the Gaza Strip is basically what's been going on in the Gaza Strip for the last decade, only more so. There have been a few rockets fired by a few of the ragtag militant factions that are rivals to Hamas. None of them's really done anything when they've reached Israel, if they've reached Israel. So some of the rockets have injured some other Gazans when they misfire. And Israel's launched a lot of retaliatory airstrikes and blamed Hamas for everything as usual. But the escalation on the Israeli side seems to be a lot more right now because of the sort of hysteria surrounding those kidnappings in the West Bank.
Yeah, and now, this resolution that the U.S. blocked in the U.N., is that what this was about? Was about the collective punishment in the name of these kidnappings?
Right, it was. It deplored the deaths of the five Palestinian civilians killed in the West Bank and expressed concern about the mass arrest of people without charges in the West Bank. Jordan was sort of critical of the resolution because they felt like deplore wasn't a strong enough word, and they wanted it to be changed to condemned, which I'm not sure if they have like a list at the UN of which word is worse than which word. But then the United States came along and said, oh no, our red line on this is you can say you deplore the deaths of the Palestinians, but you can't mention anywhere in there the fact that they were killed by Israeli troops, and you can't mention Israel at all in the resolution.
And so veto.
Right.
And, so, and did it actually get that far where they vetoed it, or did they just kill it in committee kind of thing, or what?
Right, and it never came up to a vote after that. Once the U.S. laid that out as a red line, it was basically dead, and there was no point in.
Right. Yeah, same old there. And then the siege is still just the same as ever, or the same as since Morsi was overthrown a year ago, and the Egyptian military clamped back down on the only somewhat partially reopened Rafah crossing. It's still just full-scale siege like back in since 2008, 2009, right?
Right, it's back to that, and you know, it's not really very controversial in Israel right now because of the kidnapping hysteria. In fact, you've got politicians on the hawkish end of the parliament calling for the them to clamp down even more in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, saying, well, we should shut off all the electricity to both occupied territories. And getting some support, although it doesn't seem like it's enough to pass a bill. Crazy. At least not yet.
I wish we had more time, because I wanted to ask you a little bit about the party politics in Israel and their debate about annexation of the West Bank and all that, but I guess I'll have to wait till next time. But thank you very much for coming back on the show, Jason. I sure appreciate it.
Sure, thank you for having me.
He's great on everything, right? Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. We'll be right back. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Hey, look, we got Marcy Wheeler back on the show. EmptyWheel.net, that's her blog, and that's her handle on Twitter, too. Hi, Marcy, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing real good. Oh, did I say Marcy Wheeler? That's your actual name, not your internet name. So she's not a lawyer, but she's as good as any lawyer in North America at reading legalese and telling you what it really means or what they're trying to obscure with it or whatever the hell. And she's a great writer, and she's really brilliant, and she cares all about the Bill of Rights and all the right ways, and it's great. So EmptyWheel.net, that's where you read what she writes. And so we got some all kinds of legal happenings today. First of all, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously did anything right? That can't be right. Really?
Well, we won't talk about the Aereo decision, which is a cluster. Can I say that word? Cluster?
Yeah, we know what you meant.
But no, 9-0. This is, as Oren Kerr pointed out at the Washington Post, this is 27-0 for the last three technology-related Fourth Amendment decisions at the Supreme Court. So they're coming around slowly. Our Supreme Court is learning.
Yeah, well, I just saw... well, never mind. That's not important enough to waste your time with. So now what exactly was at issue here with this cell phone search?
A couple guys who were stopped by the cops, and after stopped, the cops searched their cell phones and found incriminating evidence via the cell phones that busted them for other crimes, drug-related crimes, that kind of thing. And the Supreme Court held that they have to get a warrant before they do that going forward.
Mm-hmm. And now, they had been relying on the case of the matchbook full of drugs, right? Or the matchbox full of drugs that, hey, I had to search the guy when I arrested him. And so it's not my fault that I found heroin in his pocket when I had to do an inventory of his personal belongings. And so screw him. And they were saying that's the same thing as opening his phone up and reading his email.
Yeah, not just the phone, but I mean, not just the, finding drugs in a cigarette case, but also, searching for guns or what have you. Sam Alito wrote a kind of pathetic concurrence. He still bought off on the opinion, but he was sort of like, I think you are misstating the reasons we have approved those kinds of searches. And he kind of raised your point, because Roberts said... Roberts focused on the need to search people to make sure that suspects didn't either do something to hurt the cop or destroy evidence. And he said neither of those is going to happen in this case. So there's, so the interest clearly lies with privacy. And Alito said, but wait, we like to search for other reasons, but otherwise I agree with the opinion. So that's basically what Roberts said, though, is that there were a bunch of great lines. It's actually a fun read, but one of them, he's like, I'm going to misquote it, but he basically said, the data in a cell phone can't hurt a cop. It's true. Although, I think you'd find some governments who would disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And certainly some cops who would disagree that the pictures in a phone can't hurt a cop, but whatever.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to argue the bad guy's case here or whatever, but based on the precedent that they can open up a matchbook to see whether there are drugs, you know, stashed in there or not, or a matchbox, I guess was the case, if I remember it right. There's nothing in a matchbox that can hurt a cop either, right? I mean, there could be evidence in there, but I thought that the precedent was we stopped them for jaywalking, and it's not our fault that he happened to have heroin in his matchbook, something like that, right?
Yeah, that would be the destroying evidence case. What Roberts said is basically you're not going to be able to wipe a phone when you get arrested, and a phone is not a cop's ability to access an encrypted phone is not going to change whether they immediately search it or not. So neither of those reasons, which are the ones the government gave, are compelling enough to amount to a destruction of evidence case like the heroin in a cigarette case.
Right. Now, I saw a speech by Jonathan Turley one time that was just masterful, really, about how the war on drugs was used to erode the Fourth Amendment, and he went off on a kind of chain of consequences about roadside searches and how it had always been, you know, hey, you need a warrant just like any other search on the roadside. But then because of the war on drugs, they started, you know, well, you know, you're out on a public road after all. And so and you're in a license, you have a license and you have tax stamps and registration stamps on your car and all these kinds of things. And so it's not quite your private property free from search as much anymore. And they started lowering the threshold and lowering it and lowering it and using excuses like, come on, we can't go to the judge's house and, you know, in the middle of the night, miles from here and wake him up and that kind of thing. And then Turley pointed out that, yeah, but, you know, ever since the invention of the cell phone and the text message and all of that kind of thing, they didn't repeal their precedent that said that going to the judge's house would be too much of a hassle or whatever. That was left over from a long time ago, when in fact it wouldn't be a hassle at all to get a warrant on the roadside because of the technological advance. But, oh well, the precedent's set and we're going to go ahead and only get worse from here, never better kind of thing. And so it seems like they've got, you know, so many loopholes that, I mean, really, they can get a warrant just as easy as not at this point. So really, what difference does it make? All our cell phones are belong to them anyway.
Well, that's what I think is the honest takeaway, is that for arrest warrants, I suspect the cops will build in a warrant to search a phone. Roberts did still allow for exigent circumstances to require a search, although I don't know what good it's really going to be. So you're right. For those circumstances, I think that the reality is still the same, although I think it makes it a lot harder for the government to use a traffic stop as the excuse to get your phone to search to find the evidence that they probably already have via some illegal means to then convict you on a drug case. So,
talking about the parallel construction. This won't be an excuse they can use.
Right. And I mean, it's not just parallel construction. I mean, if cops want to harass you, that's what they do anyway, is they stop you and then they kind of keep searching until they can find some legal means. And that's actually something Robert said. He's like, if you search through somebody's phone, you're going to find some evidence of illegality in there, whether it's that you were speeding or whether it's that, you know, what have you. But that's sort of the point, that, those cell phones. And again, the language on it was, I think, really at the end, he sounds like the frickin' ACLU. He's like, here's the instructions we give you, get a warrant. And it was pretty good on a lot of levels. And he maps out, there's about 8 paragraphs in the middle of the opinion, which I think will be cited from significantly as we go forward, talking about why cell phones, and he said, you know, he says cell phone isn't even the right term for it. These are computers. These are cameras. These are Rolodexes. These are all these other functions rolled into one, and that makes them different. And he went so far as to say that searching a cell phone is actually more intrusive than searching somebody's home, which is right, I think, but it's a pretty radical statement from where the law enforcement community is right now.
Yeah. Well, and considering whose clerk was writing it too, that's pretty good. And now I see what you mean when I saw you on Twitter pretty excited earlier that, hey, I think there's a lot to work with in this decision for citing on NSA cases all around here, right?
Right. I mean, I think You know, 2 years ago in the U.S. versus Jones decision, which was the GPS tracking equals a search, we had three different opinions. We had Sam Alito writing, you know, the plurality, which basically said this is property-based. We had people like Breyer, who can actually be terrible on law enforcement issues, saying, well, there may be limits. And we had Sonia Sotomayor by herself saying, look, you know, technology requires that we reconsider these precedents. And I think it is not too much to say that today's opinion represents the rest of the court coming around to her position.
It sure is nice to hear you say things like that. Everybody, hold on. We're going to be right back with Empty Wheel. I can't promise it's all going to be such good news, but it's going to be good. So hang around. We'll be right back after this.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Marcy Wheeler. EmptyWheel.net is her website and her handle on Twitter. And we're talking about this unanimous Supreme Court decision. It says the cops can't just go rifling through your cell phone on a fishing expedition unless they got probable cause they can show a judge to get a warrant to do so. Which it ain't perfect, but hey, it's something. And like you're saying this is the Supreme Court coming around to the point of view that, you know, we really need to reassess all this kind of thing. It seems to me like it's sort of like the Geneva Convention prohibition on torture is really vaguely written deliberately in order to be all-encompassing, right? No degradation and this kind of thing. So where it can kind of apply very broadly. Same thing with Amendment Number 4. Papers and effects. My effects are protected. Sounds to me like that means all of my property of any description whatsoever, right? I mean, how can they define that down? That means the things that belong to me. And so I guess I'm always afraid when the Supreme Court is ruling on things like this because their word is final. For when they get it wrong, it can be a real hassle, But when they get it right, it can really matter. And like you're saying, some of the language in here is so good, it's bound to be invoked in all the rest of these court cases on the NSA and the FBI and all kinds of stuff here.
Sam Alito's concurrence was pretty funny because he's like, I just think we need something more complex than just saying Fourth Amendment. And I laugh so hard. I mean, you know, he's supposed to be conservative justice, yet the Fourth Amendment is simple. And that's what Robert said, get a warrant. So that's great. You know, we can finally get back to the simplicity of the Fourth Amendment, you know, in a limited fashion, although I do think that this opinion is going to have, is going to impact other things.
Right. Yeah, that's great. You know, it's pretty rare the Bill of Rights wins a victory like this. So that's really good. Now,
you're not going to bring me down, are you? Don't do that to me.
Do what?
You're not going to make me sad now, are you? Don't do that.
Oh, no. This one is still good news. I got two more good newses, and then if we still have time, I'll get to some bad news.
I'm going to run out the clock. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, you can do it. I know you can. Well, I'll go ahead and give you both, and then you can measure the time out however you like. First of all, some federal judge struck down the no-fly list thing? That's absolutely unbelievable. You got to fill us in. And then I saw you tweeting something with our friend Cade Crockford on the Twitter there about a judge ruling against this FISA Amendments Act, Section 702.
See, now you are bringing me down. That's a bad decision. That decision...
I was trying, though.
I thought you were also going to talk about drones, but we did that already this week.
We could,
no,
well,
the,
yeah.
The 702 decision is in Portland, the case of the Christmas Day bomber, the Christmas Day FBI sting, pretend to press a button, not really a bomb case.
Right.
And in that case, he challenged the constitutionality and the judge said, no, it is constitutional. A little bit of crazy decision, which I'll write about in the next couple of days because it makes no, I mean, his understanding of the FISA court is just nuts. you know, because he kind of made assertions in one line and then the next line said, but the FISA court does something entirely different. So it doesn't make any sense, but, you know, he's a judge and he gets to not make any sense, I guess.
Oh, boy, did I read that tweet wrong then?
Yeah, sorry. No, Cade was telling me to get on it and depress everybody, and here I was wallowing in victory. Yeah. And then the no-fly...
Hey, you get to celebrate when you win one. It's okay.
I was going to spend the whole day, and here you want to bring me down.
Well, I'm sorry. The no-fly thing, that's a good one, right?
Yes. And I haven't read the opinion in detail, but basically what it argues is that the FBI is not providing people due process to be able to get off of it, which is not only important. I mean, the plaintiffs are, as ACLU always does, the plaintiffs in that case are really, it's very easy to be empathetic to them because, you know, veterans and solid upstanding imams and a bunch of people who have no business on the no-fly list. But also, I think that by unpacking the sausage making that the government uses to put people on the no-fly list, we're really going to be able to connect the back end, the process the NSA uses to kind of dragnet everybody and decide which Muslims they're going to selectively torment, and then the front end, which is where it starts ruining people's lives. So it's unclear what's going to be rolled out, what kind of due process is actually going to happen. You know, I suspect that the government will try and appeal this because they hate losing any prerogative as the executive branch. But for now, at least, it brings something. I mean, we've got two decisions in a row that say that the no-fly list is unconstitutional. The earlier one wasn't quite that strong, but regardless, two decisions in a row that say that the no-fly list doesn't fly. And I think once you recognize how central flying is to people's lives, I think that decision can only be upheld. And, you know, the more we insert due process back into the places where the war on terror has removed them, the far better off we are going to be as a country. And frankly, the far better off, I mean, even from an efficacy standpoint, this sausage making process that picks which Muslims to torment doesn't work. I mean, the reason these people who have no business on the no-fly list are on it is because their process doesn't work. And so the way to fix that is with due process, but also with enough transparency to be able to point out that their algorithms or whatever the heck they're using just simply don't work.
Right. Yeah. A little bit of accountability to set things, you know, more properly. You know, you referred to that case, the entrapped Christmas plot there. You know, these kinds of things are going on in our country all the time where the FBI, they're just basically, you know, holding their jobs, spending their budget, and trapping idiots. But meanwhile, Faisal Shahzad is trying to blow up Times Square, and Tsarnaev's trying to blow up Boston. But they're still screwing around, just doing things the old way, because that's what works well for them, not works well for security for the American people whatsoever. So there has to be accountability, or else they just keep doing the same thing.
Yeah, so... So, really exciting.
I mean, I could imagine, it, you know, like on Airplane One, where, like a little kid sets off the metal detector and then a bunch of Islamic Jihad terrorists walk right through behind him with shoulder-fired missiles and stuff. That's the kind of thing I'm imagining. The bad guys squeaking through because they're too busy, you know, hassling a little old lady in a wheelchair, or, you know, the equivalent. So, good point there, yeah. Now, so I'm out of good things to ask you about. You can bring up stuff if you know of any other good news, but otherwise I need to ask you if you know anything more about the drone memo that you think you need to mention to us, and or about the CIA report that now I think has bureaucratically moved from one place to the other, and now it's left only to the president whether he's going to release this thing or not.
Yeah, which depressing thing do you want me to talk about in 5 minutes?
Oh, in fact, you only got like 2.5. So
all right, well, The short version is the torture memo. CIA says it has delivered it to the president, and he will make the final decision. And one of the things that's been in the background through this whole declassification process, not only is CIA trying to protect itself, of course, but also the president is trying to protect the allies who helped us torture. So one of the things that the White House is probably going to spend the next 2 months redacting, because they told Jason Leopold, who has a FOIA in on this, that he's going to get it, or that it will be delivered to the Senate at the end of August. So they're going to spend 2 months, you know, crossing out all the places that talk about the British torturing or the Polish hosting torture sites. So that's where we're at.
There you go. Like we don't already know all about that.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I just explained everything that's going on, but whatever.
Right. Yeah, it's ridiculous. But I guess they figure the longer they draw it out, the less anybody's going to be in trouble.
And they're going to release, yeah, and they'll release it when everyone is off at the beach. So I'll be here, though, reading it.
Oh, that's good. I mean, and yet we're still only talking about the summary, right? They're not even considering releasing the actual 6,000-page thingamajig. Am I right?
Correct. Although when Dianne Feinstein, to her credit, when she released it, she says, eventually the whole thing will be released. 20 years from now. Well,
can't wait to read your blog that week. Holy crap. All right, that's the great Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net. Thank you, Marcy.
All right, take care, Scott.
All right, you guys. That's it for the show today. We'll be back here tomorrow, noon Eastern, on Liberty Radio Network. ScottHorton.org. ScottHorton.org/donate.